Just over 200 Montanans managed to sign up for health insurance in the first month of Obamacare. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the latest on the Little Shell Tribe's fight for federal recognition. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with biographer Bob Drury about his new book on the legendary Sioux warrior chief, Red Cloud. Federal officials say 212 people in Montana signed up for insurance in the first month of the online marketplace that is a key part of the nation's new health care law. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services today released state-by-state numbers of people who enrolled through the new exchanges between October 1st and November 2nd. Health officials say a total of 2,683 people in Montana submitted applications through the federal exchange and 212 selected plans. Across the nation, 26,794 people in the 36 states relying on the federal exchange website, which includes Montana, managed to enroll for health insurance in the first month. The federal website's rollout has been plagued by technical problems that have prevented most people from completing applications or even registering with the site.
And in other news from around the state, a national immigrants' rights group has filed a civil rights complaint with the Department of Homeland Security after a Mexican man facing deportation said he was raped while being held at a Montana jail. Ademio Orozco Ramirez told the Great Falls Tribune he was in a cell with nine men when he was held down and raped on October 5th. He says he believed he lost consciousness after the attack. Orozco Ramirez, who allowed his name to be used in the story, reported the assault on October 7th after being moved to a jail in Idaho. The National Immigrant Justice Center is asking Homeland Security's Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties to investigate. The complaint questions whether the Jefferson County Jail in Boulder had adequate safeguards to prevent an attack.
The State Commissioner of Political Practices says he is expanding his ongoing investigation into allegations of illegal coordination between candidates and independent groups. Jonathan Modell said today that he is looking into complaints against four more legislative candidates in the 2010 election cycle. Last month, Modell said he found evidence that so-called dark money groups illegally coordinated spending with one candidate without reporting the contribution. State law bans independent groups from coordinating their expenditures with candidates. Today's filing says there is reason to believe the groups offered similar coordinated assistance with other Republican legislative candidates. Modell says more complaints could be coming for 2010 and 2012 races and cautioned 2014 candidates to pay attention to the rules.
Montana's Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians continues a long battle for recognition by the federal government. It's the only state-recognized tribe without such a federal distinction. The 4,500-member tribe owns a building in Great Falls, but no reservation land. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the tribal members are hoping their federal status will change soon, and the state's congressional delegation is behind the effort.
Little Shell Chairman Gerald Gray says, in essence, his tribe has been looking for federal recognition for 130 years.
But technically, it's been about 35 plus years.
Recognition would allow the tribe to provide certain federal services to members.
Some education services, definitely health care. I mean, we could actually start our own Little Shell clinic, housing needs.
And it's something the Little Shell already had. Chairman Gray says the tribe was recognized by the federal government in the year 2000. No substantive negative opposition was recorded at that time, but 9 years later, the Bureau of Indian Affairs changed its mind and took that decision back. Gray says the Bureau listed three concerns when it removed recognition: whether the tribe was an Indian entity between 1906 and 1935.
Proof of community over time, whatever that is.
And whether the tribe could prove political authority. Gray says Little Shell debunked those concerns. Senator John Tester believes the decision was inappropriate.
And the fact that they granted recognition and there were no negative comments and then they rescinded recognition, that's a huge problem. And that tells me that they've got a broken system.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs did not return repeated calls seeking comment for this story, but Tester says the Bureau is currently re-examining its rulemaking process. Until then, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell has written a letter to Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn, asking Washburn to reconsider the tribe's application. But Tester says the Bureau is currently re-examining its rulemaking process. Until then, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell has written a letter to Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn, asking Washburn to reconsider the tribe's application. Little Shell Chairman Gerald Gray says Washburn has the authority to officially recognize the tribe. Otherwise, it needs to go through Congress. Senator Tester is sponsoring a recognition bill for the Little Shell. Senator Max Baucus is listed as a co-sponsor, and that bill recently received a hearing in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. Over in the House of Representatives, Congressman Steve Daines is sponsoring a House bill which mirrors Tester's legislation. Senator Tester says even though he is sponsoring the bill, he'd rather the Bureau of Indian Affairs recognize the tribe without Congress.
Anytime it happens from a congressional level, it's done a lot of times for political reasons and not the right reasons, and that's why the department needs to do it.
Tester does want Congress to act to boost the budget of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which he says was cut during the federal sequester from levels which he says were already too low. But he acknowledges that kind of money is hard to come by in Washington these days. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Great Falls Public Schools has reached a $595,000 settlement in a lawsuit filed by the families of seven special needs students who reported suffering physical and verbal abuse in a middle school special education classroom. The Great Falls Tribune reports the out-of-court settlement was reached in mid-October. The families of the North Middle School students claimed the children were abused on several occasions between 2007 and 2009. Superintendent Tammy Lacey said yesterday the district's insurance provider recommended settling the case to avoid further legal costs. Attorney Cliff Edwards, who represented the families, said the families believe the size of the settlement should be enough to prompt changes in the school district and ensure the abuse never happens again. Charges were filed against two paraprofessionals but were later dismissed.
The chairman, president, and CEO of Boeing refused to speculate on what may happen if the aerospace company's machinists reject an 8-year contract extension. Jim McNerney was in Missoula today to present the annual Harold and Priscilla Gilkey Executive Lecture Series at the University of Montana. About 20,000 Boeing machinists in Washington's Puget Sound area are voting today on the contract extension the company says it needs to assemble the new 777X carbon fiber-winged aircraft in Washington. Some union members have called for a no vote, protesting concessions Boeing wants in pension and health benefits. Earlier this year, the company announced a $35 million expansion of Boeing Helena, which fabricates complex components for commercial aircraft. McNerney says he hopes the Washington machinists don't vote on the contract. If they do, he says Boeing will consider all available options.
And we will evaluate them and decide. I'm not prepared to say that we're moving in one direction or another. I think the big point is that this airplane that we want to build is a spectacular airplane that our customers want. And the where and how we build it will be decided upon over the next few months. Hopefully, the vote will be positive today.
McNerney's formal presentation focused on leadership, innovation, and competitiveness. He told the nearly full house at UM's Denison Theater that Boeing has specific expectations and qualities it demands of its leaders throughout the company.
They must be able, at the highest level, to, number one, chart the course by generating clear and simple strategies and clear and simple plans for their teams to follow. Secondly, set high expectations for themselves and for others. If you don't do it for yourself first, you have no credibility, obviously. Then, number three, inspire others through words and actions to help them meet those high expectations. Fourth, find a way to overcome setbacks and conquer unexpected obstacles, but not just in any way, because a short-term gain is never worth harming the company's or your reputation.
He said companies that grow and outpace their competitors share a number of key characteristics. Those include effective management of business diversity and equal emphasis on both growth and productivity.
They're life cycle developers of products and services, not solely developers of products. And they retain the capacity for both fundamental innovation and disciplined execution, never letting creativity and discipline become mortal enemies in their organizations.
McNerney says Boeing takes global warming very seriously.
I mentioned the 787, 20% emissions improvement. That's huge, and that cost a lot of money to develop that, both in the engines and in the airframe, the composites itself, much lighter airplane. So it is a big part of our capital development budget. I would go on to say biofuels is a big piece of the scientific work that we do at Boeing, which, as you know, the net-net impact on the environment, since these organisms will soak up a lot of CO2 as they grow, and then they burn cleaner when they get into our machines. But it may surprise you to learn that as much as all of that, you know, improvements in technology focused on the environment, biofuels, that modernizing the air traffic control system has as big an impact as those things.
He says that means more efficient routing of planes can have resources as well.
Stillwater Mining Company is reporting a net loss of $201.5 million for the latest quarter after slashing the value of its copper reserve in Argentina. The Billings-based company announced yesterday that it had reduced the value of the Alter Copper and Gold Project to $102 million. The company in part cited uncertainty about Argentina's business climate as a drag on its investment in the country. The precious metals mining company acquired the Alter Reserve in 2011 as the centerpiece of a $487 million cash and stock purchase of Peregrine Metals Limited. Former Stillwater chairman and CEO Frank McAllister was ousted earlier this year, in part due to investor discontent with his pursuit of Alter. That effort was joined by former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, who replaced McAllister as chairman.
The names of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull are well known, but another, less famous Native American leader had at least as great an impact on history of the American West. A new biography seeks to rectify that gap. It's titled The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend. Red Cloud was an Oglala Sioux chief who was the only Indian to win a war against the U.S. Army. The book is co-written by the best-selling biographers Tom Clavin and Bob Drury. In this feature interview, Drury talks with news director Sally Mock about Red Cloud's legacy and how they came to write his story.
Our métier, so to speak, is ordinary men who rise to extraordinary occasions in war, and that was typical of the sailors we wrote about in Halsey's Typhoon, and the Marines we wrote about in The Last Stand of Fox Company, and the Marine security guards we wrote about in our Vietnam book, Last Men Out. So, I've spent the last 20 years as a war correspondent. I've been downrange, I've been to Iraq six times, Afghanistan, Darfur, Sarajevo, all these beautiful places. And so I'm very friendly with military guys. And I happened to be down in Quantico, and I was speaking to one of the historians, the Marine historian down in Quantico at the Marine base. And we were just kicking around ideas, and I said, oh, I've got this World War II idea we might do next. And he said to me, hey, why don't you, kind of jokingly, he said, why don't you do one on the only Indian to ever defeat the United States in a war? And I was like, well, what do you mean, Sitting Bull, the Custer? And he said, no, I didn't say a battle. I said a war. I said, who are you talking about? He said, Red Cloud. And he threw me a, he dug through a file cabinet and he threw me a, oh, it was a magazine story, it was an appreciation, something like that. And just as soon as I read it, I said, wow, this is, not only is this a wonderful subject for a book, but look what it encompasses, the opening of the West, manifest destiny, the post-Civil War migration. And I took it to Tom and we decided then and there, this is our next book. I mean, this is a big, epic, sweeping adventure with a very interesting man who, I wouldn't say he was an ordinary man who rose to extraordinary circumstances, but he was an extraordinary man who rose to extraordinary circumstances.
And not before your book, all that well known. You mentioned Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. We've heard of them, but Red Cloud not as well known.
Well, not a martyr, certainly the first two you mentioned. I think Red Cloud, in fact, I don't think I know. Look, Red Cloud got lost in the wash, the tide rolling over history. The Sioux Empire of, say, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, of course, this is in the 19th century. This is when he rose to the pinnacle. This is when he became the warrior chief of the Sioux. And then during the 2 years that we delineate as Red Cloud's War, which he won, and, you know, the United States basically came crawling to him and saying, what do you want? We'll sign any kind of peace treaty you want. And he signed the peace treaty. And then, I must say, the U.S. was smart enough to bring him east. Now, he wanted to go east. He was a shrewd politician, and he saw what was happening to the American Indians in general, and the Sioux in particular, and he said, let me deal with the head man. I want to deal with your president, who at the time was Ulysses S. Grant. And so we said, sure, come on east. And once he got east of the Mississippi and he saw what the United States was all about. He saw the civilization. He saw the railroads. The first place they took him in Washington was to the Navy Yard, and they gave him a gunnery demonstration with the cannons. And so 10 years later, when the U.S. once again broke another treaty and went into the Black Hills, the first glint of gold, and off we go, and Crazy Horse, whom Red Cloud had mentored, kind of picked him out as a teenager and said, I want this wonderful fighter to be my field commander. And Sitting Bull, who did not have the greatest relationship with Red Cloud, but they were allies of a sort, they came to Red Cloud and said, listen, we got to fight the white man again. He broke his treaty again. He's going into the Black Hills. And Red Cloud said, I've been east. I've been east of the Mississippi. You don't know what it's like. You don't know how many guns they have, how many men they have. I'm not going to get my people killed. And so he ended up living out his life. He lived to be 89 on a reservation. And the romantic martyrdom that befell Crazy Horse, that befell Sitting Bull, that befell Geronimo, did not befall Red Cloud. And I think that's a little bit why the tides of history washed over him.
You mentioned that Red Cloud saw what was coming in terms of the population push and so on. The book points out that in 1866, there were fewer than 2 million whites in the West, and 25 years later, it was 8.5 million.
The easy way to say that is gold. But it wasn't all gold. A lot of it was gold. Up in your neck of the woods and in Idaho, and don't forget, the United States was struggling. We had a massive debt. The national debt from the just-completed Civil War was overwhelming. So gold had a lot to do with it. But also, you have to figure, in the course of Red Cloud's, I was going to say lifetime, but just in the course of his adulthood, we brought Texas into the Union. We settled the border with Great Britain at the 49th parallel, the Canadian border. And we defeated Santa Ana to take in the Southwest, California, parts of Utah and Colorado. So it was a question of, okay, we no longer, we used to use this breadbasket of the country, this middle portion of the country. I mean, mapmakers just labeled it the Great American Desert. Nobody knew what was really out there. We used to use that as a buffer against foreign powers. But now we didn't need a buffer anymore. We'd settled things with the Brits. We'd settled things with the Mexicans. And so it was like, okay, we're going to become a continental power. And that's exactly what happened. And Red Cloud, as I say, once he went to Washington, once he went east, I mean, he went to New York, he went to Chicago, once he went east and saw the might of this country he had been butting heads with for a good 20 years, he realized that it was a fait accompli.
And at one point, he said about this Western migration of whites, Red Cloud said, quote, now we are melting like snow on the hillside while you are growing like spring grass.
Oh, he was a smart man. He was a smart man. He was fighting for his people. And that's, I think, back to your first question, how did two white guys end up writing about Red Cloud? I mean, everything about him, I mean, he was a military, a brilliant military strategist and tactician, but he was also a shrewd politician, and he had foresight. He was a far-thinking man, and he saw the inevitable, and he said, okay, after he won his war, his next step was, let me try to get as much for my people as I can, because we are shrinking. We were small to start with, and now when I see what these European Americans, what they are, how they exist, what they do, I realize we can't compete with this. I mean, my favorite Red Cloud quote is, the white man made me a lot of promises. He only kept one. He promised to take my land, and he took it.
The book doesn't shy away from the brutality of these Indian wars and talks about how captured white people were, quote, scalped, skinned, and roasted alive, among other things.
Well, that was a way of life. That was a way of life on the plains, the northern plains and the southern plains, from the Comanche to the Sioux and everyone in between, whether it was Pawnee or Cheyenne, Crow. They knew what the deal was, so to speak. There was one of the interesting things that we found in our research that, I mean, it's kind of become a cliche, the happy hunting ground. But in fact, it wasn't exactly called that, but it was pretty close. The Plains Indians did believe, and the Eastern Indians also, they did believe that there was a place that you went to after your death, and it was flowing with beautiful, clear rivers, and it was full of buffalo and game, and there were calmly beautiful maidens and horses, any horse you want. But you arrived there in the same condition you left this life. So if you arrived there without your eyes, you couldn't see how beautiful it was. If you arrived there without your arms to pull back a bowstring, well, then you couldn't hunt for this wondrous game. If you arrived in this afterlife without your private parts, well, then you couldn't take part in carnal knowledge, carnal activities. Everyone understood this. I should say all the American Indians understood this. And I know, to the whites who were just settling the West, or to the cavalry who were called on to save the settlers, to the miners who came out, and a lot of these men were veterans of the Civil War, and they had seen all kinds of carnage, but they had seen nothing like this, and it shocked them. But we ran across a journal where two privates actually made a pact to not be taken alive by the Indians, to kill themselves. They would either shoot each other in the head, or one way, extra shoelaces, all cavalrymen and dragoons and mounted infantry, they wanted extra shoelaces because they would use that shoelace to tie one end to the trigger of the rifle and the other end, and the other end to their toe, and they would just turn the gun on themselves and blow their brains out. They knew what was coming, and it was shocking. Depredations is what the newspapers would call it, but to the American Indians, it was just a way of life.
The title of the book comes from the Sioux name for the Black Hills, which were and still are sacred to the tribe.
Pahasapa is the heart of everything that is. In fact, Tom and I were just speaking yesterday. We've been speaking to some of the elders, as you probably know, or perhaps not. Oliver Red Cloud, who was Red Cloud's great-great-great-great-grandson, he just recently died, and his son, Oliver was 91, and his son, who was scheduled to become chief of the tribal council, actually chief is a white man's word, head of the tribal council, he recently died at 71. And so the Sioux Nation is in a bit of flux right now. They have never given the United States permission, so to speak, to go into the Black Hills. According to the treaty of 1868, the Sioux still own, although the concept of ownership is foreign to them, but they own the Black Hills. And there was a court settlement, I believe, back in the 70s for millions and millions of dollars, and the Sioux refused to take it. And it's now over $1 billion. And that money is just sitting there while these battles win their way through different district courts.
The title of the book is The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend. And I have been speaking with the co-author, Bob Drury, who wrote this book with his co-author, Tom Clavin. It's just a fascinating read and a history that's well overdue being told. So thank you so much.
Oh, Sally, thank you for your kind words, and thank you for having me.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with scattered rain showers, isolated snow showers, and some patchy freezing fog. Just some patchy fog. Expect lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow. There will also be some patchy fog and highs in the 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind watch in effect from late tomorrow night through Friday evening for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with isolated rain and snow showers, as well as lows 25 to 35 degrees. West wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with highs 40 to 45 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it calls for partly cloudy skies with isolated rain and snow showers through the night with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Abraham Kim.
Last week, while visiting Beijing, China, I appreciated once again how large our world is, and at the same time, how small it is as well. While scaling the Great Wall and walking through the grandiose Imperial Palace of the Forbidden City, I was reminded how historically rich and culturally diverse the global community is outside of the United States. At the same time, as I passed the bustling street of this metropolis of 21 million people buzzing with market activities, I also realized how interconnected our worlds are. What is occurring in Asia, thousands of miles away from the United States, matters in Montana in many different ways. With the free flow of global commerce, communication, and travel, we are all linked together. These realities are often not fully appreciated until one travels abroad and experiences new cultures and new societies. This is why Montanans, especially our students, should travel abroad to study and experience as much as they can to expand their perspectives and better understand the diversity of our world. This message seems apropos this week as we mark International Education Week at schools and universities across the United States. Recent trends at American universities suggest that going abroad to study is increasingly becoming an integral part of curriculums to prepare students for their careers. Because our society is becoming more multicultural and our workplaces are becoming more globalized, future professionals will need to be better equipped to work with people that come from varied cultures, values, and languages. Certainly, studying abroad and living in foreign countries are all great training to prepare for this increasingly complex future work environment. A 2013 report released by the Institute of International Education shows encouraging news that more than 280,000 American students are going abroad to take courses and enroll in schools. This shows growth of more than 300% over the last 20 years. Montana has also shown significant growth in the number of college students going abroad. In 2011, 513 students went overseas. This jumped to more than 650 Montana students in 2012. Although this growth is very encouraging by Montanan standards, when compared nationally, the Big Sky State has a long ways to go before it can catch up with other states. For example, many state universities, such as the University of Minnesota and Michigan State University, each send more than 2,500 students abroad every year. If we are to prepare Montanan students to be more competitive in our globalizing economy, we need to do a better job in encouraging, inspiring, and supporting our students to think and to go global. This endeavor should not just focus at the college level, but should start as early as elementary schools, teaching young students foreign languages and cultures to expose them to our multidimensional world at a young age. On the other side of the spectrum are the foreign students coming to the United States. According to the Institute of International Education, the U.S. is still viewed as the land of educational opportunities and attracts more than 819,000 university students from all over the world. These thriving foreign students are contributing in numerous ways to their host communities. Economically, foreign students injected more than $24 billion to the U.S. economy in 2012. In addition to economic benefits, incoming students have filled the increasing need in this country for more students in the science and technology fields. Furthermore, international students have connected the world to our U.S. classrooms and diversified our communities across the country. These students are often the most promising young people in their respective countries and are anticipated to return back to their home nations to become the next generation of political, business, and academic leaders. In the U.S. academies, these emerging leaders are building relationships with their American peers and forming a deeper understanding of the United States. This people-to-people engagement in our schools may be one of the most effective forms of public diplomacy in reinforcing U.S. foreign relations in the long term. Despite these clear benefits, the state of Montana collectively is only attracting approximately 1,600 foreign college students each year. Even with these comparatively small numbers, incoming students have been a boost to our state economy by contributing more than $42 million in 2012. With the natural beauty of Montana, our world-class universities, and being one of the most livable places in the U.S., there's much potential for growth. Looking ahead, the state and its universities may need to make a better effort in marketing to attract foreign students, in actively building relationships abroad with academic institutions in key markets like China and South Korea, and in aggressively expanding exchange programs to draw students and professionals to Montana. In conclusion, as we mark International Education Week in Montana, This is a great opportunity to reflect on how we can energize our schools to substantively promote global education so that more of our students go abroad and to attract increasing numbers of foreign students here. In the end, these efforts will not only enrich our communities and educational system with diverse cultures and new talents, but will also contribute to the overall welfare of our great state.
Abraham Kim is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment about tonight's newscast, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.